Chapter 4, Why the Need for Pain. Many parents on this journey ask me, why is it so important for our kids to feel pain? Because, I tell you, pain and struggle teach a brain deluded by addiction that the costs of addiction outweigh the pleasures. Words don't work. Pain is the thing that keeps us up at night evaluating our own behavior. Pain is the thing that makes us want to do something different and change our lives. The pull of drugs may be so extreme that circumstances may need to get really bad before the counter reality of pain becomes enlightening. If using drugs is a slice of heaven where pain, misery, disappointment, and insecurity disappear, why stop? Only because left to run its natural course, addiction causes uncomfortable consequences, physically, emotionally, spiritually, and socially. So our loving may be as simple and as hard as not easing the discomfort of the natural painful consequences of addiction. When we ease our kids' pain, we are also alleviating the compulsion to accept our help and change. Every time addiction is made more comfortable for our kids, addictive behavior is reinforced. Sally, a mother of three, called me from her southern town, frantic about her eldest son, Burton. She told me that Burton was alternating between periods of cocaine use with periods of bulimia. When using cocaine, he didn't eat or sleep for days, and when he ran out of drugs, he would binge, eat, and purge. He would gorge himself on cookies and snack foods and then throw it up in the bucket he kept by his bed. Weeks of no eating alternated with weeks of gorging and purging. Sally said, "He is 6 feet tall and weighs only 110 pounds. His hair is lifeless. His skin is starting to look dry and gray. He looks so sick. I am just sure he's going to have a heart attack and die." "Have you talked with him about getting help?" I asked. "All the time. It seems like nothing else comes out of my mouth," she said. "But he is so ugly about it. He cusses and tells me to mind my own business. He claims he is fine and that I'm the fat one with the problem." A few days later, I was sitting in a hotel meeting room with Sally, her husband Tom, and Burton's brother and sister. All of them express their revulsion about his bulimia mixed with anger about his rude behavior. "It's just gross," said younger brother Mike. "Mom buys all this great food and he sneaks it up to our room. A few minutes later, I hear the crackle of packages opening and then him eating as if he can't get the food in his mouth fast enough. A few minutes later, I hear him puke. The smell makes me gag. It is disgusting. He sleeps with that bucket next to his bed and spends all night eating and puking. I like it better when he's using coke. At least he doesn't gross me out." His sister was stone silent. "I don't want to be here. Every conversation we have in this family is about him." They prepared their intervention statements outlining their fears for his well-being. When I asked, "So what action are you willing to take if he refuses treatment?" "These words you're writing are lovely, but new boundaries need to be backed up by action, or it's just more talk." Sally handed me a piece of paper she brought to the meeting. "This is my boundary," she said. On the paper was a square with print inside it which said something like, "Notice. If you see Burton G., please tell him that he needs help. He is a cocaine addict and a bulimic, and I am sure he's going to die if he won't accept professional help. If you have any compassion for him, me, and the rest of our family, please do not ignore this situation. We, his family, need your help. Signed, Sally G." I read the letter stunned. "What are you going to do with this?" I asked. "I'm going to publish it in our local paper," she said. "If I'm going to be printing an obituary soon, then I might as well print something that might help first." She said this with absolute resolve. "Okay, then," I replied. The next day, we began the intervention early in the morning. Burton came into the room and turned around on his heels when he saw us sitting there. His father strong-armed him back into the room, and I got a chance to see how sick he was. Sally was right. This boy, for he looked like a very tall 12-year-old, was going to die if he didn't get help. He grudgingly sat down. His father, grandparents, and siblings read their intervention letters with clear concern and emotion in their voices. He sat through the letters as if he was made of stone and said in an expressionless voice, "You're all crazy. I don't need help." Sally then read her letter and handed him the notice she intended to publish. Burton looked at the piece of paper and said, "What the fuck is this?" Everyone in the room gasped at his language. Sally calmly told Burton what she had told me. "If I'm going to be publishing your obituary soon, I'm going to publish this first. I am not going to sit by while you kill yourself." "You are crazy," he said. "You would never do this. You care too much what everyone in town will say," Burton said defiantly. "Watch me," she said, and got up from the couch, grabbed the phone, and began to dial. She said into the receiver, "Classifieds, please. This is Sally G, and I am interested in taking out a full-page ad as soon as possible." Burton levitated off the couch, grabbed the phone, and hung up the receiver. "Burton," said Sally, "you can stop me right now, but understand one thing. I will publish this notice unless you go to treatment today." At that, Burton's anger seemed to evaporate, and he began to cry. "You can't do this to me," he said through his tears. "Yes," she said, "I can. Sure, I'll be embarrassed publishing the letter and airing our family business in public, but I'll do it." All the fight gone, Burton got off the couch, packed his bag without any more resistance. Sally called me a couple of days later and said, "I feel so much stronger. It's like I let our family's dirty little secret out of the bag. I sure learned what my children hear when I talk, though. Blah, blah, blah. From now on, it's words and consequences."